Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Good morning. It's Thursday, April 25th. This is the Main Course OG. I am Emily Pearson, and I'm here in studio with my co-host, Patrick Martins.
Thanks for having me.
And I have another co-host here. His name is Max Martins. Can we get a hello, Max?
Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
That was Max Martins.
Spring break here in New York. So we have our guests for the weekly grill are Aaron Oster, the co-founder and chef of AOK Berkshire Barbecue in North Adams, Massachusetts, and a former chef here in New York with a pretty great track record. Cesare Casella, Il Buco Alimentari, you were a baker for a bit, turned barbecue master. Is that right?
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks for coming on. One of our best listeners. We also have Chef Justin Kingsley Hall of the forthcoming Main Street Provisions in the Arts District in Las Vegas, and former chef at the Kitchen at Atomic, where we've worked together, and Sparrow and Wolf. And before that, California?
California, Florida. So my pedigree is more muddish. I travel around.
The bayou.
Yeah.
We like that. And we also have calling in our good friend, Eric Koss, publisher of the Alameda Sun. Good morning, Eric.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Our West Coast panelist. I like it. We're national, baby.
Yeah.
With you.
Big time.
We like the East Coast, West Coast rivalry in here with a little bit of, you know, Vegas and the Berkshires.
Do you always get up this early, Eric?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I love you guys. Actually, I always like to point out that I grew up over there. I'm a native New Jerseyan. So the time change hasn't
kicked in yet. But also, everyone wakes up early in California at like 6 o'clock, it seems, and then has dinner at like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It just seems a little bit that way.
Like we're retirement
yoga on the beach in the morning and, you know, all that kind of thing.
We're skipping over Las Vegas when we make that statement. We know that you're all sleeping still at 10 a.m. and dinner, you know, last call is at 1 a.m.
I just mean San Francisco, actually, yeah.
All right. We will try not to offend.
By the way, Joe Biden announced he's running today.
Oh, yeah?
I just got 6 Instagrams from him in a row.
From him, direct messages?
Yeah.
He let you know.
Is he going to buy any shanks?
Yeah, hopefully.
Exactly. All right, we're going to jump right into our segment, the weekly based. First topic today, we are talking a little bit of diets here. Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food, said Americans spend more time and money on dieting than on eating. I'm going to out him right now. Patrick's on the cleanse.
Yeah, I'm on the master cleanse, the maple syrup, lemon, cayenne, pepper, and water. And then you can look forward to an herbal laxative tea at the end of the day. But I find the cleanse okay. That makes sense to me. That's about cleaning your insides. I mean, I have an occupational hazard of going out all the time, eating, trying things, meats, cured meats. So I think cleanses are cool. And if you can lose weight, it's fortunate. Dieting, I've never think that works. And that kind of bothers me. But a cleanse, I kind of am okay with that. Is there a difference?
I don't know, man. Well, I think you're right about the cleanse, like scrubbing the inside of your body out and trying to wring out all the years of abuse.
Yeah.
But diet is like, it's a little bit more restrictive, right? It's more of a...
I think it's a complete lifestyle change. A shock for a few days.
I think that's the problem is diet is not a complete lifestyle change. It's like a temporary fix. You know, you're like, I don't feel good about my body. I want to lose weight, do this. And then, so you go on this diet. And then at some point you're getting off of it, and then you're like, well, the weight came back. And it's like, well, you've got no like steady idea of what your lifestyle is going to be. And I think that's where most people trip up, you know, is trying to figure out that long-term fix instead of like, you know, just trying to lose the pounds. And then they're going to magically stay off once I start eating bread again.
Right.
you need to stay on that laxative tea and maple syrup program
forever.
Forever now.
That or why not just like weave in some form of it? I think everything has to be, you know, it has to be sustainable. It can't just be short term. Otherwise,
well, that's the thing. I go to my doctor. I'm like, well, how many times can I eat hamburgers? And they're like, that's not the point. You have to lead a healthy, balanced lifestyle. And that's hard. And I think most people in America especially are like, go all out on the chips and the pretzels, pizzas, and then they're like, now I gotta fix it, but I can still eat pizza twice a week, and that's not how it's supposed to be. You're supposed to eat salad most of the time and lighter things. So
I like the cheat day idea, though. I think there's something like healthy, like mentally, about that. If you, you know, kind of have a good routine and you're not cutting anything out completely, but maybe you have one day. I don't know. Do people go to Vegas for the weekend and it's all just a cheat weekend? Yeah, cheat week.
Vegas is the cheat kind of situation.
George Burns lived to be 105, you know, with his cigars, and he always claimed he ate beet juice only on Sundays. That seems to me the best thing. You go, you live your life. If you go out, you drink, you do your thing, but on one day a week, you're just, I'm only drinking beet juice.
I think like it's weird because we all try to like do the same thing together. Like, hey, this is the best way to eat. This is the best idea. But reality is like our bodies are all different. We're all, you know, better suited for a certain meal plan or something. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you know, I've known people that live to be 100 off of greens and some mm-hmm. people live to be 100 off of pork belly.
That's amazing. Well, that gets us into our next question.
All right. Is there one ingredient you worry your child will hate? What I mean is if this child did not like this particular item, you might think that you were not the father. Like, it's so wrapped into your DNA, they're coming out and this child must love this food.
This isn't like foods you love. This is like real DNA, something that goes back 10,000 years.
Well, it's got to be tomato sauce for me. You know, if you got like any Italian in your blood these days, I think it's partially made up of tomato sauce. For me, if there isn't a tomato on a meal, it's kind of like there's something wrong with it. I don't know. Maybe I'm
So you don't I'm do the too, white the white pizza is like a sin.
Well, I like the white pizza too. That's good, you know, every now and then. But yeah, I think balance is very important when we're talking about the diet stuff. You know, you got to balance joy with responsibility. You know, you got to have your kale and you got to have your pizza. And you know, I think keeping it in moderation is always good.
Mm-hmm. What do you guys do? Where are you from originally? Like your family.
I mean, I'm Russian-Hungarian Jew, so...
Cabbage!
Yeah, a lot of cabbage. I mean, if it makes you smell or it smells up the house, that's, like, pretty critical. Potatoes, onions,
I love cabbage. Yeah, same.
So Russian. There's a concern, though, if your future child, you know, did not like cabbage, not yours?
This question was posed via email a day ago, and I looked at it, and I thought to myself, I don't know if I would make a big deal about it. I think if my future child didn't like eating in general, that would be a bigger thing. You know, like parents who have kids who just like, listen, I'm eating, the kids are making their food decisions. I think that that's ridiculous because I grew up in a house where they've put food in front of us and that was what was to eat. You know,
yeah,
and a lot of chef friends I know, that's how they treat their kids. Mm-hmm. They just take them out to food and there's not really, it's not negative. It's just like, hey, we're going to eat this today. You know, and a lot of it smells right. Weird to kids, but
I think it's me as a dad. I've got a 2.5-year-old son, Kingsley, who actually a lot of people watch him on Instagram because I got so sick of posting pictures all the time. They're like, post more pictures of him, that I made him his own Instagram eating with Kingsley. And it's funny, he has like 500 followers eating around Vegas.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, I was trying to figure out that like balance, whereas like I grew up and I remember, you know, my dad trying to force me to eat broccoli, and he gave me a decision. He was like, you either eat the broccoli or you go up and get your ass kicked. And I was like, Jeez. 5 years old, and I walked upstairs, and my dad's like, where are you going? My mom's like, you looked right at him and said, going for a spanking. And he tried not to laugh, and he sat there, and I went upstairs. But it was this constant battle, and I didn't want my son to have that same fear of, like, what's on the table. So he started eating solid foods around 8 months. And I just put him in the basket and we'd ride through Whole Foods and I'd pluck a radish off, you know, different things all the time. And he would just start going through.
Shoplifting. Cool.
Yeah, pretty much. but it was amazing to kind of see him just kind of like pick everything. So, you know, we'd go out to some of the fine dining restaurants, Bardot and Harvest and stuff, and all the chefs know him because he'll, you know, we just put stuff in front. There's no kids menu for him. There's no, it's just, this is what, but today, if you don't want it, you know, some days he's vegan.
And he's the newest restaurant critic, it sounds like, of Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. You know, you put it in front of him and he either gives it the thumbs up or is like, eh, I'm done.
Well, this question we should re-ask because, you know, DNA, I think DNA and me or whatever, 23andMe, sponsored the radio, which I was like, amazing. That's, how did you cross over into that demographic of these people who want to learn their genes? And it's because they think food is a big part of the history. Yeah. So if I was sick, I would, part of me says I should go back to only eating cabbage, and that maybe my body is, you know, clamoring for its genetic predisposed foods versus not being the father or whatever. Because it is interesting. I mean, most people don't really think, oh, where are my ancestors from? And what foods are from there? And do I eat any of that food? Because if you don't, then you're kind of, it's like a schism.
A lot of the foods from at least my family's lineage is made for old people or babies anyway. You know, like matzo balls and like potatoes and onions and cabbage, you know. Mm-hmm. It's easy to chew. That's the idea.
And Russian doesn't really have that amazing a cuisine, only because of how cold it is there. Like, there's not very many Russian restaurants. There's the Russian Tea Room here, and pelmeni, maybe the dumpling is some word that people have heard, but there's not like 100 Russian restaurants.
No, there,
well,
there
we
is.
We also associate them with vodka. I don't think right, we right, associate right.
Which
them
is
with
a
the
tasteless
food.
Drink.
Vodka and caviar.
Yeah, no, there's a place that just closed on 6th Avenue. It's spelled One Gin, but it's pronounced Onegin. And oh. It's, you go for these like huge parties, but they take the cuisine of other cultures. Like, they're really big into sushi, and it's anything that's like big and platters and plentiful, and then vodka and caviar.
Max, what's your least favorite food? The food you hate the most in the whole world?
I think it is caviar.
Caviar? All right, well, that's a little anti-Russian, but that's cool.
Wow.
I'm still your dad.
And on the flip side, it's his sister's favorite food.
Yes, exactly.
At the moment.
I think that would hurt my heart if my son was like, no caviar for me.
That's a good answer.
Hey, but it helped. It makes life cheaper. It saves you some money, for sure. So Aaron's a pretty regular listener, and I know he's been anxiously awaiting the chance to answer this particular question. Our favorite Duchess, Meghan Markle, is due to give birth in a few days. She has asked you, Justin and Aaron and Patrick and Max, to create a single bite to celebrate the birth. What do you advise? Do you innovate or do you do a classic?
All right, so Max, what's your favorite food of all time? Single favorite food.
I think my favorite food is ice cream and candy.
All right, well, there's from Max. Meghan Markle should serve people ice cream and candy.
Maybe like an ice cream sundae bar. Yeah. You top your ice cream
with
candy.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. Mine, for English people, I would still go with, I would go actually, no offense, Max, caviar. A little thing of caviar. What a nice gift that would be for the English people to celebrate the birth of their future prince.
Nothing to do with eggs, right?
Yes, and eggs, yeah. What is your, the best bite?
So I was thinking here while I was coming back to New York City, like, what is the quintessential thing? And it's a bacon, egg, and cheese on a sesame seed Kaiser roll.
Yeah, Kaiser.
Yeah, man.
Like, that's a New York thing, right? You can go to other places and say bacon and egg and cheese on a roll, and they're like, what is that? I'm like, really? You're asking what is
a
that?
A Kaiser roll is very New York, and then some places they call Portuguese rolls. True. Are they the same?
Portuguese rolls have potato, are more potato-based, I think.
Yeah, they're a little flatter and less crustier, I think, the Portuguese one.
No way, man. That Kaiser roll with poppy seeds, even just a roll with butter. That's just like, you got to get that Kaiser roll. I'm going to go with Kaiser roll.
And the buttered roll is, it's not a great bread in particular, but something about it for breakfast, a buttered roll is very New York. Every stand, you know, one of those mobile stands across the city, thousands of them are sold a day. What were you going
to
say?
Can I just tell you, like, it was so hard for me to give those up moving to California. Like, the Kaiser roll and the breakfast sandwich sold just about everywhere in every gas station, every 7-Eleven and Wawa and whatever. We don't have that out here.
I know. Why? What do you do then? What's your substitute?
They're broken.
Fruit?
They don't have
tacos.
They don't have diners.
Lettuce.
They don't have a lot of stuff I got, you know, totally reliant on the East Coast.
I love diners. I mean, Mike's famous line about a diner is he'll walk out of the table if someone asks for a menu. Because he's like, you need a menu at a diner? You can order whatever you want.
I think it's still funny that the menus at diners are still like 25
pages long. All greasy and plastic, cryovac'd.
You know, there's still spaghetti and like, there's like weird tuna fish casserole in there, but people are ordering the same.
A lobster.
terrible idea.
They're ordering the same four things every time they go there.
So yeah, there is a loss of that. So you don't really have a diner culture or a breaded roll, buttered roll?
not the 24-hour diner culture. I mean, there's places that do that kind of menu, but they close at like 2. And so if you're out late, or you know, you got the late shift or something like that, you're kind of, you got slim pickings.
You don't have a slice place either, slice pizza, right?
No. Yeah, it's really hard to find a slice place. There's one place here in Alameda, they call themselves New York Pizza, sell it by the slice, you know? So that's the style.
I can't believe there's like a New York Carpets. I'm like, does that help you in Wichita, you know, to call it New York Carpets?
I feel grown up in California, and actually part of my life growing up in Alameda, Oakland, because my mom was born there. We don't have that 24-hour kind of like Waffle House diner experience
right.
that I had when I lived in the South, in North Carolina and Florida.
But,
you know, we replace it with certain things like the little, you know, smoked fish taco shops or, you know, Chinese food, it feels like.
What's the late night food in Vegas?
The late night food in Vegas? I mean,
is anything,
it's what
right?
you want to be.
5-course meal.
I love the fact that in Vegas that I can have a normal dinner. So, you know, if I get off work at 2 a.m., I run down to Herbs and Rye, and, you know, I can have a steak and mushrooms, a Caesar salad. So that for me is kind of the late night food scene there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Max, we wrote this question with you in mind. What's our next question?
we're gonna play Fuck, Marry, Kill, since I've got a lot of...
Fuck, Marry, Kill. It's a game.
It's not a person's name.
Anyway, since we are a meat-heavy bunch in here, we have chosen short rib, ribeye, brisket.
I've given it some thought, actually. And I think, you know, ribeye is going to be a little bit too tough to fuck. And, you know, short ribs, you're going to spend some time with. You got to kind of commit to them and, like, get your hands all dirty, put the work in. And, you know, brisket is nice and soft and easy and, you know, just seems like it would be a nice fuck.
I agree. Oh, and that's like, okay, wow.
I think
okay.
My jeans just got tighter.
Oh, my God.
I was really with the brisket being like the dependable one, the one you marry, the one that maybe feeds a larger group.
Well, as a Jew, that's a good one to pick.
Yeah, that's where I was going. I was gonna go with the fuck the short rib, marry the brisket, and kill the ribeye. I just kill the ribeye. It's just such a waste. People believe that is. I mean, running that butcher shop in Vegas was the most difficult thing to sort of change people's minds and be like, listen. They come in and they're like, I want a filet or I want a 20-ounce ribeye. It's like, no, you don't.
Yeah.
Let's talk more about the whole picture here. Who are you feeding? Where are you feeding them? Do you like these people? You really want to spend $80 to feed them? There's a ton of gristle on that. There's a lot of intramuscular fat. There's a lot of silver skin on the inside of that ribeye that you're not going to clean.
Fan.
Yeah, man. Adios. Yep. Say goodnight, ribeye.
Justin, where are you at on this one?
You know, I was looking at this for the past like a little bit while we're here, and you know, I have to agree on that that fuck on the brisket, mainly because you know, and Aaron, don't lie, you know when you take this thing out of the packaging and you get it all dried off, you give it a slap.
Yeah, but
you give that thing a good slap on the ass.
Yeah, but she's a dependable old lady. She's been with you for a long time.
Much like my wife, I feel like we merged the two. It is my fucking Mary.
Oh, my God. Well, you were saying earlier that there is almost a guilt about brisket at one of these famous barbecue places because they just go through so much.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I mean, 100 briskets a day, or what are you going through? 100 briskets a week at your place?
Yeah.
Do you feel guilt for hurting the environment by fucking so many cuts and serving them?
I mean, there is a part of me that says, like, is our community, I mean, we're in a small rural town that, right. I mean, the other option for barbecue is, you know, half rack of ribs for $7.
Right.
Right?
At Applebee's.
And pulled pork. Right. And we're not trying to elevate the game so much to say that we're changing the world, but we're trying to say, look, you're spend 20% or 15% more than you're going to spend at McDonald's or Wendy's with us, and we're going to give you a meal that you're going to remember with freshly baked bread and all right. that stuff. But, you know, like this guy in Texas that we were talking about, 15,000 head of cattle a year are being processed just for one dish. And, you know, yeah, there's burger joints that are taking the rest of that animal, and there's other restaurants that are taking those ribeyes. But, I mean, in the end, we really have to move towards whole animal stuff. We started selling a smoked chuck rib last week, a boneless chuck roll, and we're going to start selling clawed as well, too. And that we called it the Hot Charlie, and it just sold like crazy.
Good name, it sells.
That's what I was going to say. It's like good name. Maybe you change where the positioning is on the menu. Do you run it, you know, for just as a special? Like things get people excited. What is a Hot Charlie?
It's a 14-hour slow-smoked chuck roast served on toasted ciabatta with horseradish cream and pickles.
Mm. Very nice.
That's good.
From the one not eating over there and the one keeping Passover. I'm in.
Yeah. So yeah, you're
it's
a
great
mom
on matzah.
So you're a mom and pop shop, right?
Yep, that's right.
So do you make it a point to only support mom and pop shops?
Yeah.
You know, I asked that for you there and in Vegas and in California. And sometimes you have to go to Staples, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, in North Adams, where we are, there's a growing community of smaller shops that are providing more services, local printers that do stuff. We don't go to Staples for that stuff. But, you know, the truth is that those other businesses, we're a small business too, and so we have to maintain our overhead. So sometimes I go, you know, we go on Amazon or Webster on, but when we can support local businesses, we do. The problem is with proteins and stuff like that, in that conversation, it's really challenging.
Right, especially with large volume. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. A lot of these slow mom-and-pop businesses have not grown to the point where they can supply the amounts that certain restaurant groups need or whatever. So it's unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, I live in a neighborhood in Brooklyn where I, especially on the weekends, in Cobble Hill, I definitely try to support local, and I definitely do my shopping with specific things coming from specific spots. So, you know, whether it's Sahadi's or like my husband really likes all the Italian bakeries that are in Cobble Hill, you know, the ones that are cash only, where I'm like, oh, I hope I have at least $10 in my wallet because I want the lard bread and a coffee and cookies. And I have to, you know, ration if I'm like, oh, just the lard bread. That's all I'll take this week. But no, it's important to embrace a neighborhood. I mean, what does that mean in Vegas? Like, are there mom and pop shops?
There's definitely mom and pop shops. There's definitely a movement to do more, you know, off strip, that is locally based, our own creation of our own cuisine, and style of doing things. And I try my best to support, you know, mom and pops, those single, you know, owner operators, you know, but for a long time it's been hard because the quality just hasn't been there. And, you know, whether you're running a business or doing a lot of other things, you know, you can't just throw your money away just to support something. You have to push them to do better, you know.
Yeah, small farm doesn't mean better product necessarily. It can, but it doesn't necessarily. There's some shitty small farms out there too.
Well, like, you know, last night at the James Beard House, we were using Cape Grim beef out of Tasmania, and I use it in Vegas a lot, and someone asked me, and they're like, well, I thought you were Mr. Local and, you know, and all this stuff and supporting, you know, what's here. And I was like, well, yeah, of course. I was like, but the quality isn't there, you know, and I'm trying to give my guests the best experience possible. I was like, I'm then going to check down the list of, like, who's doing the right thing. And being able to go out there and see the move towards a zero carbon footprint and what these ranchers were doing for a product that's night and day compared to what was being offered to me. I mean, you know, you have a lot of grass-fed, grass-finished beef around that area of the country in Nevada, but the cattle are being raised on sagebrush, you know, and that's like the difference between that and what I'm getting is somebody eating Kraft mac and cheese and somebody meeting, you know, an artisan mac and cheese with real cream and milk. And
you agree, chef?
Yeah, totally. I mean, we looked at a lot of local farmers in New England, Northeast, for beef, but either we couldn't financially support the delivery because we didn't have a way to get the meat from the processing facility back to us because there's a lack of processing facilities, or just the basic raw cost was just too much, or they weren't even processing enough. I mean, 40 briskets a week is what we're selling right now, and that's 20 head of cattle, and nobody processes more than 5 you know, a week. And that's just, we could say, all right, we'll just sell more other items, but we've only been open 6 months, and we really feel a responsibility to be accessible. You know, it's a community with a median income of, you know, between like $25,000 and $27,000 a year. Mm-hmm. No one's going to pay $40 a pound for smoked meats.
And also consistency, because those guys have to pull together so many cows. You're not getting the same breed, same age, same size. It's just coming from a consortium that's like loosely connected.
Yeah, you know, and there are people who are doing great stuff. New England Family Farms has been doing a really great job creating a sort of co-op for local beef and lamb, and that's great for us. But they're not there yet. and they don't have the numbers yet to support the volume of some bigger restaurants.
Cows are tough, man. Yeah. Like in France, you don't see, I mean, a lot of people were lamb, chicken, duck, goose, you know, smaller animals. The cow, I mean, it lives forever. Then it only produces one baby at a time, and you got to raise it, and then you got to keep the breeders back. I mean, it's hard to operate a large cow farm.
There's plenty. There's plenty of pork and chickens and and goats and lamb and rabbits to go around, but beef is, you know, beef's our bread and butter. So
we always talk about like the baby back rib industry and how we just like cannot understand. I mean,
are they baby backs?
Yeah, are they really baby backs? Are people just splitting the St. Louis and calling them baby backs? Like, what is that? If you overthink that, the whole market for the baby back ribs and like what's going on with the rest of that pig, I'm just like, oh.
We call them our St. Louis ribs baby backed ribs because Max and Josie support them.
There's a stamp on the box. Yeah.
Babies support it. Well, all right. Well, mom and pop shops, Alameda Sun. I mean, tell us. I mean, it must be a big thing for you.
I mean, it is. It's our whole bread and butter, no pun intended or whatever.
Do you have business section? Like where you support?
I mean, it's all we do is promote local businesses here in Alameda. There's a pretty strong small business community, a bunch of small local businesses. We actually have a restaurant called Mama Papa Lithuania that serves Lithuanian food.
Owned by Cisco.
Cambodian, all kinds of interesting ethnic foods. But I think, you know, we're almost completely supported by small businesses. We are a small business, and we support small businesses in return. So it's like a full circle. Mm-hmm. The money just keeps going around in a little circle here on the island.
And are your advertisers mom-and-pop businesses?
Yeah, the vast majority are, yeah.
Okay, that's cool.
That's funny that you say that about how the money just keeps going around. I was thinking about that the other day, how, you know, We have a local tattoo shop in our town, and we're doing their 1 year anniversary on Saturday, and it's like, you know, we give them money, they give us money, then we advertise with a local newspaper, or we go buy signs to get printed from a local print shop, and then they give us money to buy food, and then that money from the food. I mean, it's really great to see how a small community works. And I was talking about this weekend. I don't know how long these big restaurant groups have got left to really build a small localized food community. I mean, I don't want to say QSRs, like quick service restaurants are the future, but man, like building small businesses in rural communities, like food businesses, that people are willing to travel for food, man. Mm-hmm. You know, like Emily drove 4 hours to go eat some barbecue and see some art. Like people aren't afraid to get in the car.
It was less
somewhere
than that. We're come on, New Yorkers, getting to Berkshire's it was pretty easy. And I stopped at a local mom and pop coffee shop along the way in Troy, New York, because I let Aaron plan my whole route for me. What's that called in Troy?
Superior Merchandise Company. Those guys are awesome.
So you can plan a trip from New York to the Berkshires?
Easy, man.
Oh, cool.
And he'll plan some stops for the kids along the way.
Big bladder or small bladder? You're like, small bladder tour, please. Oh, okay.
That's actually a great idea. We should create a map. You know, Tony Scotto just opened up in Nyack, the drop pastas, that bomb place, and man.
Well, those are the green highways, right? I mean, truckers always used to take the smaller highways, and now they have to take all the big highways, and so the mom-and-pop shops on the smaller ones. Like if you see Smokey and the Bandit, he's never on a big highway.
Yeah, well, that was my upbringing. My dad was a commercial trucker for most of my life, and I spent summers driving with him. But that was always the thing. It was like some little back road, and when I moved to Florida, we got stuck on a highway and got washed out, and I saw the trucks moving, and I drove off this little road. My girlfriend's like, where are you going? I was like, you just follow the trucks. I was like, they're going to take you where you need to go, and there's probably going to be something interesting to eat along the way.
In New Yorkers, grow up following cabs. When you're trying to get back from the airport, you're like, follow the yellow cabs.
Yeah, and these days, only the yellow cabs, because everyone else is looking at their GPS, which is taking them all the same exact way.
That was something that my dad really put it into my sister and I, was like reading maps on the road and like knowing what the lines in the road mean. Like a double yellow will take you to a main road. A single yellow will take you to a double yellow.
Oh, I do not know that.
So like if you're ever lost somewhere and you see a double yellow line, either drive to the end of it or keep going, because it's going to take you to a main intersection or a route. Mm. And we're right on route 2. And that's like straight from Albany to Boston.
Oh, really? That's an Albany-Boston route? Yeah. Cool.
Well, you know, you guys are talking about like rural things, but there's also these places they call food deserts sometimes in cities, like urban areas where, you know, sort of like the poorer neighborhoods are underserved and people have to leave there just to get their basic groceries and food. Like in East Oakland or other, you know, rough parts of town, people are afraid to open small businesses.
Wow,
so
that's Las Vegas.
Those people have to travel.
Same in Las Vegas?
Well, yeah, I mean, we have so many communities that people's only access to, you know, what you call vegetables and everything is the cans at the 99-cent store and, you know, talking about where they're traveling, and that's, you know, just their option. But luckily we've had these local farms, which people don't think of farming when they think of the desert in Vegas, but you have people like Desert Bloom, you know, trying these CSAs, trying to get more out to people and offer drops so they have a better access to fresh vegetables. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's, you know, an area that's considered a food city and there's all this abundance of wealth and ingredients. But it's been focused for so long right on the strip. And now these chefs are escaping to the neighborhoods and serving more things.
Well, let's talk about that. The other side of this conversation, Starbucks. What's your, I heard there's one Starbucks for every 5,100 people in Las Vegas. So mazel tov, congratulations on that.
Speaking of your food deserts, I think where all the fast food is where the Starbucks are too.
Starbucks is a sign of quality though. Like there's one that opened in my day, like is often. It? I don't know, like a Nostrand Avenue one opened, and I thought that was good for Nostrand Avenue. I didn't think it was bad for Nostrand Avenue. And yet, if one opens here, I'd be like, this is outrageous. I don't know.
Well,
it's
you know the one
bad.
That opened in, so there's two Starbucks here in Williamsburg, and there's one on like the main stretch that's totally gentrified off Bedford, but there's one that opened on Union, and it opened literally under like the cloak of darkness. They kept all the windows covered. They kept the whole thing.
Because you thought people would be mad.
They thought that the neighborhood was going to go ballistic. So they did the whole construction with everything covered. There were like a few little rumors, but almost nothing was written about. This was 3 or 4 years ago. And then one day it just opened. And so they couldn't have the backlash. They just immediately, you know, there were people that were happy.
I like that they charged $6 for coffee. I mean, I think that's cool that they showed that something should cost that much. It probably helped Heritage Foods in a way to say our meat costs $10 a pound. So you can eat for two coffees, basically, or two whatever, macchiatos or fancy coffees. But what's your stance on coffee culture in Starbucks?
Well, I was married to a woman who was the East Coast retail manager for Blue Bottle. Mm-hmm. And Alex, she's Australian, so coffee is different in Australia. You can go to 7-Eleven and get a delicious cappuccino. Coffee's everywhere, and it's a part of daily life. Starbucks here, it created a commercial opportunity to make coffee and yes, charge more for it, but it's not like a macchiato at Starbucks. It's not a macchiato that we would know of, or anybody who drinks coffee in a regular Italian style coffee would know it. I don't know. I lived in Martha's Vineyard where they were adamant about no Starbucks, no McDonald's, no none of that stuff. And I don't know if I don't know. I don't really like the coffee, and I don't know. I mean, I'm glad that their business is successful. I'm glad that they've relaunched their Starbucks Star, you know, shops that are a little bit more customized and a little bit more focused on barista, you know, technique. And I know that they opened up that huge store in Seattle.
In Milan.
And we have one here. Yeah. It just opened over by Google and Chelsea Market.
And you like it. You walk by and say, I like it.
I don't know. I think that it's shiny. It's fun. There's little like nooks. They have a full service bar. They partnered with a bakery from Milan that's doing pizza in the back. Like they definitely, the concept is there and they designed it properly. And it also isn't just enough of that like glitzy Times Square that it gets tourists in the door. But I think it offers something to the neighborhood also.
Well, I mean, in Starbucks, you know, I don't think it's the greatest coffee by any means. It's not the macchiato that you would think of in other countries and areas. But you know, they offer something that people are comfortable with. They can relate to. If they go somewhere and there's not these options, you know, they have something dependable to look at. And you know, all these big businesses are not evil for the fact that thankfully they have the money to come in and renovate and help build up certain neighborhoods.
Yeah, success is not a bad thing.
But it's, you know, that balance of not choking out the little guys and allowing them space to get their feet under them.
It's very true. Actually, a cool story from out here in Oakland, California. There's a nice row of shops on Piedmont Avenue here, and there was a big community outrage when Starbucks opened up there directly next door to a favorite mom-and-pop local coffee shop called, wait for it, Gaylords. And that place is still there doing very well, and Starbucks is there next door, and they both operate side-by-side with their own clientele. It's wow. kind of amazing.
I mean, we can't be afraid of competition. We have to evolve with it. We have to see the challenges. And, you know, if you have a better product than Starbucks, then people are going to know. If you don't, then you need to fucking work harder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, right. I agree. I like the idea that, you know, if I hope more people open barbecue restaurants in North Adams, I hope that they do it. But in a community like New York City, like, nobody cares. There's Starbucks on four corners of a block. Mm-hmm. Like, they're competing. They're not competing with themselves the way they are in a smaller community. You know,
isn't
like,
that where you met Dennis? He was sitting in a kitty corner at Starbucks yeah, across the street.
Absolutely, you love that story. Although some people say that
is that true?
If you no, 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 no. Some people say that there are certain businesses that are smart to follow. So right. like, you know, Burger King and McDonald's open in the same block because one of them has already done the market research right. to know that they're going to succeed there.
That's
so
a lazy
but you know what? It kind of works. So
name a business yeah. you do love.
A like, food really. Business.
So it's not going to be Starbucks for you.
No, it's not going to be Starbucks for me. food business I love. I was thinking about this question. I didn't know how to answer it.
Heritage Foods was named the number one response to factory farming by the New York Times.
You know what food business I really love? Huh. Heritage Foods USA, man.
Thank
I mean,
you.
That company is incredible. Yeah.
Shanks. Yep.
Yeah, let's put me down for that, too.
Shanks.
And Hearst Ranch while we're at it.
Hearst Ranch. Yeah. There is an interesting yeah. business. I love, they're mm-hmm. still, I haven't heard of any of their magazines closing. Everyone's talking about print media is dead. Doesn't Hearst still have like 500 magazines?
Oh, yeah. There's still millions and millions of
Cosmo.
Copies being printed.
Yeah. Yep. How many? What's your copy rate for the Alameda Sun?
We print 24,000 free copies every Thursday, so they're being distributed out there right now.
How many pages?
This week, 14. Cool. I keep it lean and mean depending on exactly how many ads I have. That's how many pages I run.
So let's talk mentors. Let's go around fast, round robin. We got to go to break in a minute, but mentors?
Cesare
Casella?
That's my guy, man.
Hall of Famer?
Totally,
from
man.
From HRN?
A classic.
Wow.
Yeah, Rosemary himself.
What did you learn from him most?
The thing I learned the most was that you can't communicate with the guests if you don't appreciate where the ingredients are coming from. Cesare always said, in his voice, he said, you cannot be a clown if you don't know the whole story. So, you know, he took us to Italy to see these Sulumerias, and these guys were very friendly, but he said that those guys understand where the pigs come from, they understand the process of how the product is made, they understand the business that they're running, and that allows them to be personable and do that. So don't mm-hmm. pretend to be the owner if you don't know what you're doing.
That's interesting.
Oh man, he took mine.
Yours is Cesare?
If I really think about it, you know, I worked for Cesare for almost 3 years. Aaron and I did not overlap, although we heard each other's name quite often. Probably more about sort of from the hospitality side of things and how to take care of a customer and sort of this feeling and this experience that you try to achieve in everything that you do, in how you put out your food and how you welcome people and how you do business, which could mean, you know, talking less, smiling more, you know. But Cesare just had this way that made everybody around him feel like excited to be part of what he was doing.
Convivial. Mentor?
You know, nobody's going to know this name, really, but it was a boss of mine in Florida, Paul Capsalis.
Oh, my God, Paul.
but he really forced me when I showed up in his kitchen to learn. He was like, you seem like you're a smart guy and you want to do things. That means you have to spend time educating yourself. And every day I'd come in the kitchen and he'd say, what's this word mean? What's this cut? What's that? You know, and he'd tell me, you know, always tell me, he's like, I'm going to fire you one day. He's like, because you're not going to be the chef of my restaurant. I'm the chef owner. He's like, so you're going to have to go out and do something one day. So you need to be prepared for that.
You're like, thanks?
Yeah.
Is that your
mentality now with your cooks?
Yeah, you're like, you're all fired eventually.
No, you know, when I hire anybody, even a dishwasher, I always explain to them, like, what do you want to do? I was like, if you're just coming here to be a dishwasher, I'm not going to hire you. You need to have goals, because people with goals have drive. They have a willingness to learn and be open. And so people are just coming in and be like, ah, you know, I don't really know. It's like, come back to me when you know what you want to do. And you don't have to have like your 10-year plan, but like, do you want to be in this business? Do you want to learn more?
How many people work under you guys?
6.
You?
Right now, 0.
New project.
Eric,
in the
who's
works.
Your mentor? Quick, before we go to break.
Well, last time we did Hunter S. Thompson, so I might as well throw in William Randolph Hearst, at least in terms of like showing me some of the things not to do. But also like just exactly how big you can make your media empire if you really want to.
There we go. Well, we'll go to break and we'll come right back and interview our guests.
Stick around. We'll Justin be back with Aaron and Justin.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
I'm Serena Snyder, social media director of the documentary film Eating Animals. Eating Animals is an incredible film based on the book by Jonathan Safran Foer and co-produced and narrated by Natalie Portman. It's an urgent, eye-opening look at the economic, environmental, and public health consequences of factory farming. I really love the film because it traces the history of food production in the United States and charts how farming has gone from local and sustainable to a corporate Frankenstein monster. And, you know, we don't like any of that. But instead of being a fear-based documentary, it spotlights the farmers who have pushed back against industrial agriculture with more humane practices. Frank Reese, who is the pioneering heritage turkey farmer in the United States, is featured in the film. He paved the way for heritage turkeys, which he calls standard bred. And he's also in the Heritage Radio Network 10th Anniversary Hall of Fame. So please, if you get a moment, would love if you check out the documentary.
And we're back. Thanks so much for joining us. You got a little promo about Eating Animals, a film with our good friend Frank Reese, our heritage turkey farmer. We are back in studio here at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm in studio with Patrick, my co-host, and our guests, Justin Kingsley Hall and Aaron Oster. Thanks for being with us, guys.
And Eric as our panelist.
Oh, I'm sorry. And Eric Koss. He got too quiet. Eric, be louder.
Dialing in. Hey,
dialing
guys.
In.
Eric back Koss. To sleep.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He needs another shot of espresso. So I wanted to ask you guys a couple questions.
Did you
about
plug
your
the bread
current
thing?
Well, yeah, actually, it's a good transition. So there is an upcoming bread making course. Join the world's leading bakers as they explore the future of artisanal bread. Making during June 12th to 14th at Johnson & Wales University in
Rhode Island.
With Charlotte. Yeah, but this might be a partnership with Charlotte. We'll dive deep into the issues, opportunities, and trends shaping the industry over 2 days of hands-on bread-making workshops. It's a rare opportunity to learn about bread baking. HRN will be there. Will you? Check out Johnson & Wales' website for more information about the course. And speaking of bread, you guys make all your own bread at AOK Berkshire Barbecue.
We do. Yeah, that was kind of the thing about this business. Somebody told me that we should open a barbecue place. They kind of put that in our head, my wife and I. And then, of course, we said that was a stupid idea. But then we thought about it. It was sort of, you know, Eric was talking about food deserts before. You know, there really is a lack of food and the sort of general level of like, okay, well, it's good enough to eat Alex and I, my wife, Alexandra, she and I thought, well, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it our way, which means that because there's no barbecue culture in New England, we don't need cornbread. We'll have baguette, you know. Mm-hmm. We'll serve the brioche with the brisket on a brioche bun instead of a Martin's potato bun. You know, we'll serve the chicken sandwich on a toasted ciabatta. You know, Alex is making hot cross buns for Easter. She makes huge loaves of ciabatta. She makes like white chocolate and cranberry brioche. Like, she's just doing whatever she wants to do. And the truth is that, you know, small communities like that used to have great bakeries, and people are clamoring for it. So baguettes, and I mean, she makes baguettes every week, and they're all gone. So it's fantastic. It's a nice.
And you're
change.
Making me hungry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm ready for lunch already.
I was talking about this with Justin on the cab ride in here this morning. Is that Alex has an innate ability to bake, and she just sort of like picked it up randomly. She took that artisanal bread course at FCI, and something just clicked with that woman. And it's bonkers. She drove down from North Adams yesterday to bring bread for the James Beard dinner. So
wow.
Maybe everyone needs to take a bread making course and or just go check out Alex's bread. So what
is that the only rule you've broken in barbecue? The bread?
Well, no. I mean, we try to stick to the we put porchetta on the menu. We don't stick to anything. There's no ribs at the place. There's no pulled pork really. We did it once, maybe twice. We don't have seating inside. We don't sell alcohol. We don't have a place. We don't have a ticket system for people. There's no waiting line. You just show up, you order your food, and then we'll bring it to you. We try to bring that little bit of that. What we're talking about with Cesare, like that customer service element is really huge for it. People are remembered. They're regulars. We know their names. We know their orders. We have a lot of usual people. So we just try to keep it as light and fun as possible. You know. I mean, there's not really a lot of rules to be broken, man. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a Russian-Hungarian Jew from Connecticut. My wife's Australian, so there's no lineage to barbecue. We're just smoking meat for a long time over open fire.
That's all it is? So it's not like a North Carolina style or a Texas style?
We take a little bit from where we go, from things we like. Like the brisket is definitely East Texas. It's just salt and pepper, and that's it. The chicken is sort of North African, if anything. Turmeric, fennel seed, coriander, paprika, cayenne, a little bit of cumin, and that's it's actually like Zuni Cafe, man. Like it's we salt it for 2 days, and then it gets seasoned and then smoked for 5 hours, and then all the sausages we make, because I was a butcher, so we make Mexican chorizo, we make breakfast sausages, we make Cumberland sausage, we make cotechino, we make whatever we want to do, and they just get smoked. We made a lamb merguez this week, which was really delicious. You know, we don't necessarily, I don't want to say we break rules, but we don't have any allegiance to any one style of barbecue.
Right. That's what about you? Steakhouse rules that you've broken?
Actually, you know, as far as steakhouse, like I've never worked in that environment. And what I push now is that, I always say it's kind of modern American food. What I do, which is, I know, just kind of this open-ended question, but it allows me to do whatever I want to do. You know, it's like the neighborhoods I grew up in and where I moved around, you know, it never was like one style or one group or anything, you know, from the Central Coast of California to Northern California to North Carolina, Tampa. So everything's just kind of a collection of the people I've come across in that time period.
So you have a new place opening. It's called Main Street Provisions. Tell us about it. You're going to have an eclectic style. It's what you want to cook, but is that off the strip?
It is off the strip. It's in the arts district of downtown Las Vegas, which in the past few years, whether it be cocktail bars, seasonal Italian food, has come a long way, and the city's put a lot of money into renovating sidewalks and streets and making it more of a walking area. But it's become one of the areas, along with Chinatown, that you're seeing a lot of people wanting to put money into to do their own things. In Main Street Provisions, with my boss and owner, Kim Owens, it was that opportunity that you don't have to stick to a certain style of food and ingredients, and that you have to have this on your menu to make everybody happy. It was really just she liked my cooking. She's like, we're gonna have 120 seats. It's gonna be a little more upscale, and from there just kind of do what you want. But it was that chance to be seasonal, To bring in things like the heritage foods, pork, which I've used before, but other items, the grass-fed meats.
We'll look forward to the order then.
I know. I was going to say, you heard it. You heard it here, Justin Kingsley.
On the radio. If only we have a listener to be a witness. Yeah. Where will you open another barbecue place? Any other cities? I mean, it would only be in that place, right, for you?
No, I think I don't think there's going to be another barbecue place. I think Alex and I built AOK as a brand, and so we want to open a bakery, AOK Bread. And then we want to open, I mean, Alex rolls her eyes very slowly when I say this, but I'd love to open 3 or 4 more restaurants. I'd love to open a little wood-fired fish place with a raw bar. I'd love to open a little pasta joint. We're talking about a ramen joint. Like, just, there's so much opportunity, and barbecue is exhausting.
Yeah.
And it's, honestly, it's...
You're like the Marine of the chef world.
Oh, man.
Aaron sleeps there. What is it? You're open Friday, Saturday, Sunday, so you sleep there Thursday
Friday,
night?
Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So I'm getting better at it, but I go to work at about 10, 11 o'clock on Thursday, and I don't leave until Monday afternoon. Wow. And so I smoke overnight.
Dedication.
It's not dedication, it's stupidity. You know, it's just like, you
fear
know.
Of fire.
Yeah. I mean, we're in a heritage listed building on an old mill on the campus of the largest contemporary art museum in the country. So, like, we're careful about lighting a fire inside of one of those buildings. But, man, I'll tell you, I love the barbecue concept. There's a lot of money to be made in the sense that our overhead's relatively low and the food cost is good. But there's more opportunity in North Adams and in that small community and within like a 20-mile radius that people are dying for. There's no other way around it.
Very cool. I can't believe people turn on their ovens and leave the house. I mean, it just, even though they're like, it's fine. I'm like, is it?
Oh, my wife had to get used to that, making stocks and different things. She's like, we're just going to leave. I'm like, yeah.
There's fire. It's on. Things are boiling. Anyway, well, thank you, guys, for being on, coming all the way over here. Congratulations on your James Beard Award.
Oh, no.
James Beard...
Dinner.
From your lips, buddy.
Yeah. I mean, we live up to that.
Yeah.
I mean, we're foreshadowing. This time next year, we're going to see you guys back. Someone's going to have a book up for nomination and an award.
I'll tell you, if the James Beard Association begins to put together a list of small businesses in rural communities, man, that would really be a great change.
I think it doesn't need to be James Beard. It needs to be a not pay-for-play group. Pay-for-play instantly discredits that entire operation. And plus, they had all their corruption things. A real group needs to start a kind of Zagat Guide for Sustainable Businesses, and chefs need to rate the other chefs.
There is one, Patrick.
It's HRN?
No.
I want it to be.
Well, do you know, it's called a, oh man, it's going to kill me. I think it's called Forks and, it's a guidebook.
Forks and Dives?
No, man, I'm going to find it. My wife, our friend Mindy Fox is one of the editors.
She used to be with Saver, right?
No, she was with La Cucina Italiana.
Oh,
she
was
the food editor.
Right.
And it's all about sustainable restaurants. And it's a full guidebook that's based on, you need to have a certain element of, you know, compostability, of sustainability. You need to make sure that you're responsible with your employees. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an incredible, incredible book. And it's international, too. It's not just in the U.S. I'll send you the name of it.
Thank you. Thank you, chefs.
We'll follow up with
that. Thanks, Emily. Thanks,
Eric. Thank you guys for being here with us. And,
thanks, Max, in studio.
Our pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be back next week. Have a good one.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
Cool. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.